Here we go. Didactic Mind, episode, I believe, 28. Yep, episode 28. Who watches the Watchers? Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers. Very warm welcome to my readers. For those of you who have not subscribed, please do so. Hit the subscribe button so you never miss a new podcast or upload. And today's topic for discussion is a bit more biblical than the last few that I've done. I think it's high time that I looked at things in a more, I'd say, if not spiritual, but then at least perhaps biblically informed manner. It concerns the Watchers, and that is why the title of this podcast is Who Watches the Watchers? Not, be it noted, Who Watches the Watchmen? Because that's not related to exactly what I want to speak on today. This is more about about the reason why we're seeing so much evil and corruption spreading across the world, and what's driving it. Now, for those of you who are familiar with your Bibles, you will know something about in the book of Genesis, chapter 6. I'll read it to you now. This is the English Standard Version. The Watchers were basically the sons of God, or the Nephilim, the sons of the sons of God, I should say. The Nephilim were established as the Watchers around the world. Now, if you believe that the Bible is true, and I do, then the question then becomes, who were and what were these Nephilim? Were these fallen angels? Were these the sons of God who married men and established themselves on earth and became mighty kings and demigods or godlike figures on earth? Who were they? By the way, I apologize if I sound a bit sniffly and congested, because I am sniffly and congested. For whatever reason, the significant presence of pollen in the air right now where I am is really causing some sort of massive allergic reaction, which is highly unusual. I mean, I grew up in some very dirty countries. By the time I was, 13, I'd spent my entire life in the third world. But I think spending so much time in relatively sanitary places, such as Australia, Singapore, the UK, well, maybe not so much the UK, not anymore, and the US, has made me a bit soft. So if you hear a lot of snuffling and a bit of sneezing, you'll have to forgive me. I do apologize for that, but, you know, what are you going to do, right? So the passage from Genesis that I want to read is Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through, let's say verses 1 through 5. Or, actually, you know what, I'll read the whole thing. Verses 1 through 8. So, Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. That is Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Now, The Nephilim are mentioned in like one sentence, one verse in the whole of the Bible. What were they? The Book of Enoch, which is a kind of like apocryphal book, or one of the secondary texts, mentions the Watchers very clearly. Now, the Book of Enoch was supposedly written by Enoch, the grandfather of Noah. And the question is, what were these Nephilim? What did they become? Now, I've had a number of discussions on this subject with a much more learned friend and reader of mine, actually. He lives in the U.S. He's a deeply religious man, much better Christian than I am, much more deep in the faith than I am, quite a bit older than me as well, actually. And he and I have spoken on biblical subjects many times. In fact, it is thanks to him, one of my readers, in large measure, that I am a Christian. And it is thanks to him that I bent the knee and bowed the head and proclaimed Christ as Lord. So he gets a lot of credit for that. And among the various questions and points that he posed, and the interesting ideas that he posed to me during our many discussions over the last couple of years now, was the question of, what are the Watchers? What did they become? Because the biblical account of the flood is not unique to the Bible. There are parallels and probably actually older accounts in both Greek, or at least in Babylonian mythology and possibly Greek mythology as well, of a great flood. I believe I forget exactly which it is, so forgive my historical illiteracy, but I believe it is either the Sumerians or the Babylonians who have an account of a biblical, of a great flood that scoured the land clean of life, occurring in ages past. Now, the question is, what did these Watchers become? What did these divine beings become? The Book of Genesis is not the only mention of these extraterrestrial creatures. I mean, extraterrestrial in the sense that they came from heaven to earth. There is another mention of them. I don't believe they're called the Nephilim in the Book of Daniel, but the Book of Daniel, in Book of Daniel, chapter 4, verse 13, verse 17, and verse 23, there are three references to the class of Watcher, Holy One. And he saw, this is in reference to the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, who saw a Watcher, a Holy One, come down from heaven. And you know what, let's take a look at that exact passage right now. So, Book of Daniel, here we go, Book of Daniel, chapter 4, Book of Daniel, chapter 4, and, Book of Daniel, chapter 4, verse 13, let's start here. Nebuchadnezzar's second dream. I saw in the visions of my head, as I lay in bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, "Chop down the tree and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its roots in the earth, and bound with a band of iron and bronze amid the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven, let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let seven periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the Watchers, the decision by the word of the Holy Ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and gives it to whom he will, and sets over it the lowliest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, and the spirit of the holy gods is in you." So this was when Daniel interpreted the dream. And this is a mention of the watchers who came down to watch over mankind, presumably. Now, that's in the Bible. There are a few other mentions of various similar entities in Jewish texts, in the Book of Jubilees, for instance. And there are a number of other sort of apocryphal mentions of the Watchers in apocryphal texts, the most important being the Book of Enoch, which I haven't read, so I'm not going to pretend that I know anything much about this. I'm going by the Infogalactic entry on the subject. So the Infogalactic entry says that the Book of Enoch also lists leaders of the 200 fallen angels who married and commenced in unnatural union with human women and who taught forbidden knowledge. Some are also listed in Book of Raziel, the Zohar, and Jubilees. And there are a large number of these sort of fallen angels, which is to say. And the question is, like, what are these entities? What did they become? And what relevance does this have to our modern day, where we see tremendous evil unleashed upon the earth, and an astonishing upsurge of demonic activity, where people around the world who are sensitive to these things and who are deep in the faith can feel it. I mean, I am nobody's idea of a good Christian. I'm a terrible Christian, actually, and I can feel it. I can feel the extreme paranoia and fear and terror, the extremely powerful efforts made by the fallen ones, the servants of the fallen one, I should say, to strip us of hope, of faith, and of love. We are fighting a battle against enemies that are not made of flesh, and it's written in the Bible as well, very clearly. We fight against enemies that are beyond flesh, that are in the spirit realm. And these enemies are genuinely terrifying. They are genuinely extraordinarily dangerous. And to consort with any of them is to risk one's body, one's soul, and one's spirit. It is to risk one's sanity and safety. We must at all times keep guard against these entities, these creatures. Well, what are the Watchers in that case? What part do they have to play in this? I mean, we know about the nature of Lucifer and of the Fallen One, the fact that he fell from heaven, crashed down to rule over hell, and is the source of pain and misery in this world. He is the ruler of this world. He is the prince of this world. He is the one who tempted Jesus Christ in the desert. He is the one who causes mankind to stumble and fall and move away from perfect union with God. And this is what God desires. God is removed from us on this earth because God cannot stand to be around sin. So he sent Jesus Christ in amongst us, to dwell within us, among us, and to know and understand what it means to be human, as well as to be divine. Jesus is our link to the divine. He is the intermediary who is pure, and yet, because he is also man, is capable of standing among us and being around us as sinners. So it is the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, that moves within us, and we access it through reverence of and worship of Jesus Christ as Lord and King. So we know all of that. That's all transparently laid out and mapped out for us in the New Testament. The coming of Jesus Christ was foretold in the Old Testament repeatedly, and you know, the Jews repeatedly got it wrong when they thought that he would be a warrior king. What they missed out in the prophecies of Isaiah is that There were two prophecies, actually, in Isaiah. There was a prophecy of a warrior king and the prophecy of a peacemaker. The peacemaker is what the Jews got the first time around. The warrior king is the ruler who is coming at the end of days, basically, as depicted in Revelation. That king is going to be a very scary individual. That is Jesus Christ, fully realized as Lord and King. Scary, I should say, to sinners. Scary to those who do not repent, do not bow their heads, and declare Christ as Lord. Before he arrives, that is. And there is definitely a feeling, certainly among evangelical Christians, that we're rapidly approaching those end times. I mean, things are breaking up, things are degrading and going haywire at a rate that we've probably never seen before. We've never witnessed this level of degradation in human knowledge, understanding, and wisdom quite so rapidly. A lot of people draw parallels with the fall of Rome in 476 AD as the onset of the Dark Ages. But recent historical investigation has shown this is not the case. When Rome fell in 476, in reality, it wasn't really a fall. It was just a transfer of power from one barbarian king to another. Odoacer, who took over the Roman Empire and became the king of what was at that point a Gothic kingdom, more or less, was actually a former Roman general. The Federati, who had essentially taken over the military ranks and the military and administrative ranks of the empire at that point, were the ruling class. The Goths were the rulers of Rome. The Romans themselves had stopped ruling themselves about a century earlier. So there was really not so much a fall as a relatively orderly and peaceful transfer of power. And the Dark Ages did not actually take place until about 300 years after they were supposed to have taken place. The time between the 5th century and the 8th century was not a period of darkness, gloom, despair, misery, as is often depicted in modern histories. That period was, in fact, a period of great economic and cultural flourishing. Why? Because the Visigothic kingdoms of the former Roman territories, which were Christian in nature, really began to flower. They took over what was left of Roman civilization, and in some cases they actually advanced it to beyond what Roman civilization had achieved up to that point. But those Dark Ages really arrived only after the expansion and spread of Islam in the 8th century. In sort of the late 7th to early 8th century and all the way through to the 9th century, it was not until the 9th century and pretty much the establishment of the proper establishment of the Holy Roman Empire that 100 or 150 year period or so of true Dark Ages ended. So when I say that we're progressing rapidly downhill, I really do mean it's at a pace that we've never seen before. We're not talking in the space of dozens or hundreds of years, or scores, we're not talking in the space of a dozen or a score or a century of years. We're talking about within the space of like 5 to 10 years. We're talking that relative time frame. That's what we're talking about in terms of the fall of great empires, great civilizations. The reality is the United States has maybe 15 good years left. That's it. I'm assuming that, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, will be reelected in November, because, as much as the mainstream lying hornalist media wants you to believe otherwise, he is still very much the best hope that the United States has. and his leadership during the Kung Flu crisis has actually been excellent overall. Sleepy Joe Biden has been nowhere to be found. He is an absolute disaster of a candidate, and it's hilarious to watch because his sheer ineptitude is astonishing. But assuming that Donald Trump is reelected as president, what happens then? Well, the U.S. still has maybe 4 years of solid leadership. Then what? Who comes next? Because at that point, the vast yawning chasm of America's fiscal problems will be too large to ignore. I mean, this year alone, in this fiscal year alone, the United States is going to run a minimum of a $4.5 trillion budget deficit. Just a deficit. That's adding to an already existing roughly $22 trillion of debt. $22 trillion plus $4.5 trillion, and that number is likely to grow. Thereabouts, $1 trillion of debt against a $20 trillion economy. This is not sustainable. This is madness. This is insanity. The United States is going to fall. There is no way back from this. There is no possible return from the abyss. The U.S. has already tipped over the edge. It's going to smash onto the rocks at the bottom. There's no doubt about this. So, we know all of this. I mean, all of this has been foretold and narrated and explained in various ways in biblical prophecies. I don't interpret biblical prophecies literally. I don't think that's the right way to interpret them. But there is no doubt that many of these events have already been foretold. What about the Watchers? What part have they played in all of this? Well, my friend who I was talking about earlier talked to me on a number of occasions about the Watchers, and he mentioned that these Nephilim who fell to Earth may well have become the gods of old, the gods of ancient mythologies. We know, according to the Book of Enoch, that these watchers, these Nephilim, were both good and bad. So there were some watchers who were benign and tried to help mankind, and there were others who were genuinely very, very nasty. The watchers are, you know, they are free creatures with their own free will and spirits, and some of them have chosen to rebel against the Lord. They've really enjoyed their time on Earth, and they've watched over. Excuse me. And they've watched over mankind in various parts of the world. Others have not been so benign and have really led mankind down a very, very dark path in various parts of the world. You know, if you look at the Infogalactic article on the subject, lists various watchers. Arakiel is the watcher who taught the humans the signs of the earth. Amaros taught men the resolving of enchantments. Azazel taught men to make knives, swords, and shields, and how to devise ornaments and cosmetics. Gadar-El taught the art of cosmetics, the use of weapons, and killing blows. Barakiel taught men astrology. Bezaleel is left out of most translations of the Book of Enoch because of the damaged manuscripts. Cambriel or Chazakiel or Ezekiel taught men the signs of the clouds, meteorology. Kokabiel, apparently in the first book of Enoch, he is a fallen watcher, resident of the nether realms, and commands 365,000 surrogate spirits to do his bidding. Penemue taught mankind the art of writing with ink and paper. And also taught the children of men the bitter and the sweet and the secrets of wisdom. Shemyazaz, or Samyaza, is one of the leaders of the Fall from Heaven. Interesting. Shamsiel is once a guardian of Eden, and served as one of the two chief aides to the archangel Uriel when Uriel bore his standard into battle, and is the head of 365 legions of angels, and he also crowns prayers, accompanying them to the fifth heaven. And he is also a fallen angel who teaches the signs of the sun. And Jekon, was the ringleader who first tempted the other watchers into having sexual relations with humans. And his accomplices were Asbiel, Gadriel, Penemue, Kazadia, who were all identified as individual Satans, quote-unquote. So, as you can see, the Watchers have a number of different roles and responsibilities. And you can immediately, if you know your Greek mythology, you can immediately see the parallels between them and the various Greek gods. You can immediately see the parallels between Zeus or Jupiter. I mean, you know, Greek and Roman gods, they're basically the same. Between Zeus the Thunderer and some of these watchers, between Apollo, god of the sun, and these watchers, between Hermes, the swift, the messenger, Athena, goddess of wisdom, Aphrodite, goddess of beauty, Vulcan or Hephaestus, god of ironmongery and forging. So that's just Greek mythology. Now, what about other mythologies around the world? Well, if you go to Japan, they also worship a pantheon of gods. I mean, there's Amaterasu, the goddess of life, who, you know, I believe she was the reason why Japan exists in the first place. By the way, I'm not that familiar with Eastern, you know, Chinese and Japanese mythology. If I make a mistake here, that's on me. I apologize. Please, you know, forgive me for that. If you are more knowledgeable, by all means, correct me in the comments. But if you look at Indian mythology, I mean, Hindu mythology is, again, a pantheistic religion where you have the divine trinity, Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. And then you have 27 or so lesser gods and goddesses who cluster around and kind of help things along. And sometimes make things go worse. And the funny thing is that the king of the gods, Indra, is not one of the original trinity. He's a separate character. So you can see, if you look closely enough into the pantheistic religions of other cultures, some very clear parallels between the Watchers as they exist on Earth and the depictions of very powerful divine beings in other places. Now, does this necessarily mean that Watchers came down from heaven, landed on Earth, and became these extraordinarily powerful deities? Maybe. If you look at the mythology of ancient Egypt, you know, that's exactly what you see. A group of entities that are not exactly immortal. They can be killed. Horus was killed and sent to the underworld, and rose again from the dead with the head of an eagle, basically. So the legends and myths and mythologies of other cultures show some very striking parallels between the Watchers, as described in the books of Enoch and very, very briefly, in the biblical texts. Does this mean that there are Watchers among us, coordinating our actions and leading mankind to some very dark places? Does this mean that there are other Watchers among us who are trying desperately to influence us to do good? I believe both answers are true. I'm no theologian. I am well aware that to non-religious audiences, this all sounds like complete madness. And, you know, that's fine. You know, I'm not particularly bothered about what atheists or agnostics might think about what I'm saying. I'm just spitballing right now. I'm just throwing out ideas, seeing what sticks, and you know, I'm happy to be educated or corrected about anything I've said. If I've misspoken on something, then by all means, let me know and fix my understanding. I would very much appreciate it, in fact, because I don't know what's out there. I'm just speculating based on what I've seen, the evidence that I have in front of me. The question that I have is whether the dramatic increase in extreme spiritual unrest that we're seeing around us can be attributed to the Watchers. I believe it can, at least in part. I believe it can. And I also believe that the ways in which different cultures have evolved and changed through time is directly attributable in some way to these Watchers. Because if you accept that the Watchers, the Nephilim, came down from heaven, fell to earth, copulated with human women, and bore sons through them, and they are the sons of God, the Nephilim are the sons of God, and thereby spread across the earth and ruled over various parts of the earth, if they are indeed of the spirit realm the same way as God the Father is, that means that they don't have to be physically present on earth as physical human beings to influence events and to influence cultures. If you look at the cultures of Central and South America, I believe you can make a very strong case that there are Watchers who came to reside in those countries. And by the way, also in North America, pre-Columbian North America, I believe there is a strong case you can make that Watchers came to reside in those cultures with the direct desire to reduce mankind to savagery and barbarism. Why do I say that? Well, just look at the Aztec and Incan and Mayan religions. The Aztecs believed that their sun god was constantly being chased around by a terrible demonic entity that would swallow the sun and destroy life on earth unless it was appeased through sacrifices of human blood. I believe the sun god of the Mayans is known as... the Aztecs, is Huitzilopochtli, deity of war, sun, human sacrifice, and the patron of the city of Tenochtitlan. Now, Huitzilopochtli, or however you pronounce it, was one of the chief deities of the Aztec religion, and he is seen as the sun in their mythology. His many male siblings are perceived as the stars, and his sister is the moon. The reason why the sun is constantly chasing the moon and the stars is because because of the way that Huitzilopochtli came to be. Basically, if you look at the origin stories, the story of cosmic creation among the Aztecs says that according to one of the origin stories, there's a fierce goddess, Coatlicue, who was impregnated as she was sweeping by a ball of feathers on Coatepec, which is a serpent hill, apparently. And her other children, who are already fully grown, with a 400 male, I'm not even going to bother pronouncing that word, and the female deity, Coyol Chahui, that's it, never mind, I can't pronounce these words. These children, angered by the manner in which their mother became impregnated, conspired to kill her. Huitzilopochtli burst forth from his mother's womb in full armor and fully grown. He attacked his brothers and sister, defending his mother by beheading his sister and casting her body from the mountaintop. He also chased after his brothers, who fled from him and became scattered all over the sky. So the reason why the Aztecs constantly sacrificed blood to their sun god was so that their sun god would have enough strength to battle his brothers every day. And when the night came, you know, rather than seeing this as the natural progression of night and day, the Aztecs saw it as something to be greatly feared, because they didn't know if the sun would come up. So they would make sacrifices to ensure that the sun would come up again. Now, does that sound like an enlightened or sensible culture to you? It doesn't to me. And that that barbarism is reflected in Mesoamerican cultures across Central South America, across pre-Columbian North America. The Iroquois were infamous for their child sacrifice practices, as were a number of other Native American tribes, who had no problems whatsoever with human sacrifices of various kinds. That was true of both American, which is to say, you know, tribes that occupied pre-Columbian, the pre-Columbian footprint of what is now known as the USA, and Canadian tribes, you know, tribes north of the 45th parallel, if you will. Those tribes, the Manitoba, the Huron, the Mohawk, and so on and so forth, you know, all the Saskatchewan, all of the various tribes who lived in northern Canada also had similar practices. I don't believe that's coincidental. I don't believe that is in any way simply due to coincidence or fate. I don't believe that at all. I believe that there were entities that influenced these tribes and gave them a certain degree of cultural similarity. I also believe that there were watchers in Rome, in Greece, or what perhaps believe is too strong a word. I also think that a case can be made, a very strong case, from a spiritual standpoint at least, if not from a historical or logical standpoint, that watchers existed in Greece and Rome and influenced the developments of those civilizations. How is it that Greek civilization evolved from animists, snake eaters, and fire worshippers into the Hellenistic Age? How did that happen? What could it possibly have been the influence of spiritual entities that moved among them, impregnated human women, inspired great kings of old, great warriors of old? It's a distinct possibility. I mean, think about it. Odysseus of Ithaca, the demigods of Greek legend, you know, Theseus, Perseus, and Bellerophon, well, not Bellerophon, I don't believe is a demigod, but, you know, the sons of Zeus, Poseidon, Ares, and so on and so forth. You know, these were men, the sons of these Greek gods, of these Olympians, were tremendously powerful men, and they were the ones who created the Greek world. I mean, Heracles was the son of Zeus. He was a demigod in every sense of the word. Tremendously powerful character. If you look at the biblical account of how the Nephilim came to earth, and if you look at the Book of Enoch and what it says about the Watchers and the ways in which these creatures, these entities, spread among mankind, suddenly a lot of mythical accounts no longer look like they're just mythical. They make a whole lot more sense, because suddenly they serve as real explanations for how things evolved in certain parts of the world. If you look at the way Eastern civilization evolved, or Indian civilization, for instance, if you look at the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, these are the two epic stories that kind of define Indian culture, Hindu culture. the Ramayana tells the story of, Rama, a sort of avatar of Vishnu, or kind of Vishnu brought to life on Earth, and his quest to basically free his kingdom from the influences of the evil 100-headed demon Ravan, who lives on the island of Lanka, and so on. You know, the monkey god Hanuman gets involved. There's it's a very colorful story, and it's a lot of fun for children to listen to. Is there anything realistic about it? I don't believe so. But is it possible that something like Ram existed on Earth and did amazing and terrible feats of superhuman strength and achievement? Yeah, if you begin to think about it in terms of the influences of the Watchers, yeah, it's a distinct possibility. And then when you look at the way Indian civilization evolved, and you look at kind of the missteps, some of the missteps that it made along the way, then you can kind of begin to see the influence of supernatural spirits, if you will. Spirits that may or may not have been benign. And I'm not singling out Indian civilization in terms of missteps, by the way. I think every civilization has made terrible missteps. If you look at the Watchers in the East, in China, what happened there? I mean, if you look at the way the Confucian ethic evolved, there's so much about Confucianism that seems to make sense to a Christian mind. And yet, the core philosophy of Confucianism is totally incompatible with Christianity. Why? Because Confucianism is centered around society and the individual's relationship to society. It doesn't. The Confucian ethic rules out a direct relationship between God and man. The Christian ethic, or I should say one more thing about the Confucian ethic. The Confucian ethic says that men are basically born good, and that men have an instinctual desire to do good. That's not what Christianity says at all. Christianity says that man was created pure in the image of God and was given a spirit to communicate directly with God. And that spirit is our link, our remaining link to our Creator. But through our willful acceptance of sin, we have become separated from God. We have fallen. We are impure, and we are constantly trying to work our way back to the Lord and to a state of union with our Creator. Christianity says that we are fallen and broken, and all of our evil actions come about as a result of our brokenness. It's a fundamentally different worldview. And Christianity also says very clearly that when we shun sin, and when we try as individuals to build an individual relationship with our Creator, we become, through that act, better people. Confucianism says nothing of the sort. And indeed, Confucianism goes really, in my opinion, down a very, very wrong-headed path by basically saying that you should be unquestioningly obedient to higher authority. You should follow your father's edicts without question. You should never argue with your elders. You should never, ever talk back to those in authority. Now, you see the results of that in Chinese society. And you see the exaltation of learning above all other things in Chinese society today. We've seen it in Chinese, Han Chinese society for the past 1,000 years, in fact. Chinese and indeed Japanese society is very refined, very cultured. Japanese society, I believe, more so than Chinese. I find Heian era Japan, for instance, or the Heian flowering, to be perhaps the apex of old Eastern civilization. I do believe that the Japanese got the idea of cultural refinement and aesthetic expression far more perfect than the Chinese ever did. But both cultures, and I throw in South Korea into the mix, or the Korean culture into the mix as well, because it's of a similar strain. All of these cultures achieve tremendous things, and yet, where does East Asian culture lead, it leads to stasis. It leads to stagnation. Because the apex of Eastern culture is of a static society. It doesn't move. It doesn't breathe. It doesn't evolve. There's the Mandarin class on top, with the emperor at the very apex of the pyramid. He has the mandate of heaven. And below him are his court officials, and they're all chosen by merit. All chosen depending on how well they do on a particular scholarly exam. And if you want the details of that exam, the single best book that you could possibly read on Chinese history is The Rise of Modern China by a particular historian by, what's his name? Damn it. I used to use this textbook in history class. The Rise of Modern China by Emmanuel C.Y. Su. That is the standard text, and it goes into excruciating detail about the way that the Mandarin exams took place. It's excruciating, yes, but it's actually very readable. I highly recommend that book. I mean, you could read it cover to cover in, you know, a few weeks, and it would be fascinating. It's a great book. That book will cover a lot of what you need to know about how Chinese society operates and works. And in the end, it leads to stasis, because the Chinese are not capable of getting past the idea of merit being the only measure by which people should get to the top. And the same is true of a number of other Asian cultures. I mean, in India, for instance, the Hindu culture teaches that the scholarly class is at the top of society, not the warrior class, not the people who actually get things done, but the scholarly class. They are the most revered, the most elevated. And that persists in India to this day. Education is basically a fetish down there. They fetishize degrees and qualifications. Anybody who's ever lived in the West for any length of time knows that degrees don't determine who you are. They don't determine your worth as a person. This is, in my opinion, another influence of the Watchers, of the Nephilim. They have influenced cultures in such a way that they have evolved down very divergent paths. Some of these paths are better than others, by definition, because of the nature of the influence of these Watchers. But some of these paths are genuinely very terrible and terrifying, such as the paths followed by the Mesoamericans and the South Americans. And some of these paths have been spiritually pretty enlightened. There is, if you look at the broad scope and sweep of history, it is probably not accidental that Jewish culture or the Jewish religion established itself as a dominant force in the Middle East. It is probably not an accident that the three great religions of the world came out of the same basic place. It is almost certainly not an accident that the Greeks and the Romans were among the first to accept Christianity, and is almost certainly not an accident that it was Greek and Roman civilization and eventually European civilization that became the dominant force on earth. It is almost certainly not an accident that Christianity became such a powerful, motivating, deciding factor in the expansion of Western civilization. Christianity is a pillar of Western civilization. It's one of the three pillars. The other two are Greco-Roman philosophy and the European nations, and the three are inextricably linked together. It's probably a misnomer, in fact, to refer to them as pillars. I don't really look at them as pillars anymore. I think you could look at them as the three intertwined roots of the great tree of Western civilization. It is almost certainly not accidental either that the European languages, including Russian, including the Slavic languages, share common roots with other languages from, you know, the same region. If you look at the Indo-European language tree, you will notice that all of the various branches come from kind of one main trunk, right? It is not an accident that all of this happened all together. And it is also not an accident, in my opinion, that if you look at the way that the Altaic languages evolved, you know, from basically the Turco-Mongol languages, how they evolved. They came out of the Golden Horde, out of the great hordes that grew out of the Xiongnu and eventually the Mongols, the Tartars, the various great Khans that evolved through time. You know, all of this is not exactly accidental. It's not exactly coincidental. And I don't think it's accidental either that Africa has remained basically a hellhole throughout all of time. Africa has never developed, has never made any significant contributions to civilization, has never really been used for anything good. And I'm not saying that as a slam against Africans. I'm saying that the nature of Africa and the nature of how Africa evolved is not particularly accidental, in my opinion. Of course, I could be wrong. I'm saying that all of this comes from one particular source, and all of this, if you look at the Bible, if you look at the very earliest accounts in Genesis, and if you compare and contrast them with what comes later in the Bible, and you look at them against the Book of Enoch, there's something working there, something of profound interest, which all seems to tie together. It's all kind of knotted together in one big bundle. How is it all going to evolve? I don't know. But I do think that the fact that we are seeing such a massive expansion of evil around the world right now is indicative of something profoundly odd and possibly quite scary going on in the spirit realm with the Watchers involved. I do believe that the Watchers are heavily involved in what is happening right now around the world. I do believe that there is significant influence from Nephilim-like entities in the USA that influence the deep state. I do believe there is significant involvement of such entities in the Far East, in China, where, you know, the interesting thing about the Chinese is that for all that I don't like them and their way of doing things, I'll readily admit that the Chinese are a far preferable alternative to the extreme predations and criminal nature of the deep state in the USA. For all that I dislike the Chinese way of doing things, it is a fact the Chinese are much more sinned against than sinners on the international stage. The Kung Flu being a The Kung Flu being a dramatic and severe exception to that rule. I don't subscribe at all to the theory that the Kung Flu, the chicken pox, was in any way a deep state operation gone horribly wrong. I think that when Ron Unz talks about that, he's basically looking at intelligence reports screaming about a pandemic happening in China in November. Well, okay, that's true, but remember, the doctors were talking about a new strain of pneumonia, like this weird sort of pneumonia spreading across Wuhan in November. I mean, this wasn't news. It's not like this was suddenly a shock to everybody. This had been happening for a while. And this coronavirus was reported as spreading across China way back in November by Chinese doctors. So this intelligence report that Ron Unz bases his case upon, and I'll have to go into this in more detail in a future podcast or perhaps in a long article, I don't know. But the signs were there, and the supposedly astonishing ineptitude or incompetence of the CDC and the World Health Organization and all these other deep state controlled government arms is neither new nor surprising. I mean, I was there for the SARS epidemic of 2003. The World Health Organization was completely pantsed by that as well. And the Chinese authorities were totally useless. I mean, they were worse than useless. They were criminally incompetent. The nature of the Chinese system is such that bad news doesn't get reported to the top unless it's, until it's too late, which is why pandemics, nasty killer bugs keep coming out of China. It's because of Chinese culture. And again, listen to what I've been saying this whole time. Chinese culture is geared towards making this sort of thing happen on a regular basis. So it's neither new nor surprising to me. And the idea that the Chinese, the idea that the deep state released this virus into China, hoping to cripple the Chinese economy, and it backfired upon them horribly, doesn't make sense, because the deep state benefits directly from a strong China, from a China that keeps constantly producing cheap shit, that directly cripples American manufacturing. A strong China with a strong manufacturing base cripples America, cripples the American people, and keeps the deep state powerful. So the idea that it's a deep state operation just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if you look at who benefits, who loses, it just doesn't make sense. All that being said, I do think that there is a significant case to be made that watchers are involved in everything that's going on right now, and that the God Emperor is, in fact, a divinely protected instrument of the Lord's will. An imperfect one, an extremely imperfect one. But God uses broken tools to do his bidding. That's the nature of the Lord's work. So when you see the God Emperor going into battle against the deep state, and remember, he's been astonishingly successful, much more so than any of us had any right to expect. Remember that he is doing so against far more powerful entities than you and I can possibly imagine. He's going up against real Nephilim, who truly do influence the world. And he's going up against the offspring of those Nephilim, you know, many, many generations removed by now, obviously. But the same corruption, the same evil exists in those offspring as it did in the original fallen angels, the original watchers. So, my advice to you is to be on your guard, be careful, stay spiritually alert and awake, and remember that these watchers are out there. Remember that they are influencing the course of human history in ways that we don't really understand until many centuries later. And even then, we only understand very dimly. And remember that while it is tempting to ascribe everything in a deterministic fashion to fallen angels, remember that we also play our part. Remember that we are also heavily involved in writing our own stories. So don't despair. Don't be overly concerned. Digest what I've said. Feel free to reject it outright as the ramblings of a lunatic if you want. You know, that's fine. But just think about it for a little bit. Try to understand what's going on in a spiritual way. Try to look at things in that light of what are these Nephilim doing, and try to understand what part you play in the Lord's plan. Pray to the Lord. Try to understand his will for you, if you can. I'm very bad at it. I don't have a clue myself. But see what it is that he has in store for you. And above all, don't lose hope. Don't be afraid. We are not given a spirit of fear by our Lord. We are given a spirit of forgiveness and faith and hope and strength. Use those gifts, because you're going to need them. Because dark times, darker times than this, are coming. So be ready. That's about all I have time for. We're about at the 1 hour mark now. So many thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this rather rambling and snuffly and hoarse-voiced explication of various things that are of interest to me. And I will see you on the next one, the next domain query, or the next podcast, the next blog post, whatever. This is Didact, and this has been Didactic Mind, episode 28, Who Watches the Watchers?